Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's Monday, July 24th. We're a little bit late.
Well, we're on Block Island. It's a special Block Island broadcast.
Yeah, we're relaxing, taking it easy.
With our family.
With our family. We have Granger, Sadie, Zeke, Nico, Noel.
And this broadcast is on Block Island. It's a very small island. Off Montauk in Long Island Sound.
It's not off Montauk.
Where is it?
It's in Long Island Sound, kind of between Connecticut and Rhode Island
Isn't it in Block Island Sound?
What?
There is no Block Island Sound.
Isn't
yes, there is.
All right, look, the point is this. This is the biggest thing that happened to Block Island in many, many years.
You have to take a ferry to get here. Yes. And it's a small island.
Right. Yeah.
There's nothing here, right? Am I right?
And
nothing here.
Nothing like this podcast broadcasting as we're doing this morning.
Well, we don't know that. Okay. Absolutely. We did not research that.
All right.
But Dan and I have been coming here for almost 40 years.
Right.
And we started bringing the kids when they were peanuts, and they didn't mind that there was nothing here. And somehow they still come. They still love it.
All right.
So we thought we'd talk a little bit about what we do on Block Island. We ride bikes. We go out to eat. We walk along the beach. We cook meals in our rental house, and maybe people want to share some of their favorite things about Block Island. Granger.
My favorite thing about Block Island is going to the beach. A lot of people like to go to the beach for hot weather, and I like to go to the beach for 70-degree water and 70-degree air and 13-mile-an-hour winds, and it's just a little too cold, and everyone else thinks that swimming is too cold. And I like it. And I went to the beach today, and it was windy, and no one was there. It was great.
Okay, good. Nico, what are you?
I like going into town because we went to this little place that was an arcade, I guess 3 years ago. Last year it was a smoothie place, and this year it's called True North Outfitters. And I got in a complete outfit from them, and it was fantastic.
Right. So because it keeps changing. Cold. Yes. Because it's cold.
Because it's
and
freezing.
And you brought beach clothes.
Exactly.
And Zeke was mentioning he misses the arcade. There's no arcade this year anymore?
Not that I know of.
No, we didn't see one.
We'll look for it later.
Okay, Sadie, what do you do or love on Block Island?
Well, my true love is the beach, but I also like running on Block Island. I'm not a big runner in general, but I always run when I come to Block Island. And it's a great place to go running, and it's always thrilling because you almost get hit by a car every time. You almost get hit by a moped every time.
Or a tourist.
You're yelling at tourists to get to the other side of the street. So it's always an adventure. And actually, it's rainy today. I went running today. It was really windy. And those are some of my favorite days to go running because it's thrilling. And I always run the fastest in the rain. So
we should mention it's a little bit challenging if you're biking or running because it's very hilly. There are short hills, but they can be steep hills.
And there's zero shoulder on the road. So it's you against the car, basically.
Yeah, taking your life into your hands.
Every time.
How about you, Zeke?
I like going to the movies on Block Island. It's not actually the best place to see movies, but it's a different place to see movies. There are two theaters on the island. They are both glorified barns, and they provide a somewhat substandard movie viewing experience, but one that provides a certain rustic charm. So I really appreciate that. One particularly fun aspect of going to the movies here is actually lost to time, which is that in the old days, they used to not get current movies. That was when I was younger, there would be movies that came out maybe a couple months ago and they were kind of on a delay. And so timing which movie you saw at Block Island was its own consideration in vacation planning.
So we would hold back.
Yes.
We would not see certain big movies.
If you wanted to see an interesting movie in, say, you know, June, maybe even May or something, you might say, I'm not seeing this now. I'll see it at Block
Island. Yeah, but the other thing, I wonder if it's going to be this way when we go later, is instead of having the quizzes that they have before movies go on and before coming attractions, they have a kid come out and plays piano.
Oh, yeah. That's something that you don't get at your regular movie theater. It's a marked improvement.
It still happens.
And then they pass the hat.
And they pass the hat.
Yeah. Pass the hat around.
And sometimes the kid's very good, and sometimes he's learning.
I think the impression that they're giving is always that this kid needs the money. That this kid, he just, you know, is doing playing piano here just to get by, and that's why we pass the hat around. And, you know,
it's charming, though.
I don't contribute, but I really enjoy the performance. I enjoy that cinematic experience.
All right. Noelle?
Okay, and Noelle?
I really love the Bluffs. The Bluffs are this beautiful mountainous feature. Being from Colorado, gotta love things that resemble mountains. But what's great about the Bluffs is you can kind of picture yourself as some sort of like Bronte sister. It's very gothic. It's very New England. And again, being from the West, it's kind of a quaint, novel experience visiting them. And if you'd like to see them, I'll get a preview of them. You can watch an episode of The Affair where Dominic West and his lover go to Block Island for the day, and they stand there and talk about the ghosts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll have to look out for
that. At the Mohegan Bluffs.
At the Mohegan Bluffs.
Yeah, it's a very long stairway to get from the top of the cliff all the way down to the water. And actually, one time, Dan and I saw a moose.
A ram.
An elk.
A ram.
A buck.
That's a ram.
A large
a ram the size of a Buick Sabre was in the bushes there.
And we've often on his way there. Large turtles.
Yeah, we saw once, yeah. One of those like big, giant,
3 foot long turtles.
Yeah. Beached on the...
A lot of wildlife in Block Island. Yeah. A lot of wildlife. We don't mean the party. We mean wildlife.
Yeah,
so, what is it called? I saw a goldfinch this morning.
Really?
You
very
did.
Exciting on my run.
Right.
Very popular with birders. It's
that's true. Yeah.
In September, October, whatever, the birders are here in force. So, but we're here now.
And we kicked off the weekend in style by going out to a play, a Broadway play.
Oh, before we came to Block Island.
Before we came
not
to
a lot of Broadway on Block Island.
No, not yet.
Although when we first started coming, about 25 years ago, there was summer stock here.
Right. That's
and it was kind
gone.
Of fun.
That's long gone, but yes.
Yeah.
But in any event, so we also saw Groundhog Day, which was fun. But the special part about Groundhog Day was Brush with Greatness, Zeke and Noel know someone very well in the cast. Perhaps you can explain, Zeke.
Yeah, so we were friends with Barrett Doss, who is the, female lead in Groundhog Day, the musical. We went to school with her, went to college with her, and I don't know, she's our buddy, so we stopped by to see her after the show, and that was really nice. She, you know, she's not one of those Broadway stars who has lost touch. Very personable. It was very friendly, took us backstage, so we got to...
Yeah, oddly, Donna Murphy did not invite us backstage.
No, but Barrett
Doss did. Boom, right away.
Barrett is a performer of the people, and she really appreciates the audience.
Especially
and,
the people she went to college with for 4 years.
She gave us some like fun tidbits about how the show is done, showed us some of the props, talked to us a little bit about the... rather clever stage they have built there that has rotating components.
In the shape of a clock.
Of a clock, yes.
Which is clever.
Didn't the stage seem smaller when you were on it? It seemed like an expansive space looking up at it from the seats, but to be there...
I will tell you, I've never been backstage. Sadie, have you ever been backstage at all?
If you're counting Cranberry Elementary School, then yes. But besides that, no.
No? Yeah, it was interesting, but it wasn't high tech. It was just a bunch of props piled on top of each other.
Well, there were high tech components. It's funny, like there were just a few really sophisticated and powerful pieces of machinery. She was showing us, one part of the set that becomes lifted, perhaps, 30 feet into the air by, powerful mechanisms. But yeah, meanwhile, there's just a coat rack over here with, the 20 coats that they use or
right. And the like food that they used on stage looks very plastic and very shiny, like not very like crazy
appetizing.
Artistic or anything.
So
that was a lot of fun and a good adventure in New York before we worked our way up to Block Island.
That's right.
On the ferry. You have to take a ferry to get here. It's not an easy project.
No, it isn't. It's not for the faint-hearted. So we've got a couple of articles we're going to comment on, and we'll just, people jump in. They have thoughts. These are very evocative articles, and I know you won't be able to help but have comments. And the first one is one that I didn't see coming. It's actually an obituary of a woman named Frances Gabe, who was 101 years old. But what was notable about Frances Gabe is she was an inventor, and she invented the self-cleaning home. Now, I'm now showing here is a shot everyone can see of Frances Gabe. And you can see already the marketing limitations of the self-cleaning home because it's sold by a woman who stands in the center of the home in a raincoat with a hood on and an umbrella, which is the giveaway of how the self-cleaning home operates.
This is some photograph. I pity whoever can't see this photograph right now.
And yet, so here's the funny thing about the way this is written and the way that Ms. Gabe tended to regard her experience. It is self-cleaning home is exactly along the lines suggested by the photograph, which is that everything is kind of bolted down and there's a huge hose in the ceiling. And it just goes out and sprays down everything in the house. And just to make sure that everything's going to not suffer as a result of that, there's this heavy marine varnish on every exposed surface, such that it's not going to suffer for being exposed to the water. And this was Miss Gabe's solution to dreary housework. And she patented it and whatnot. What happened was, after years of attempting to market it, perhaps she felt she was just beginning to make a little headway, and the patent ran out, and she didn't have the money to really extend the patent. And the article seems to indicate, perhaps seeing the world through Ms. Gabe's eyes, that but for the patent running out, this would have been a big success and the wave of the future. Although I think some of us know that when a patent runs out, that just means that the idea is in the public domain. It becomes easier than ever for people to incorporate these principles in their building, and no one chose to do so. So this is the only self-cleaning house, notwithstanding many
millions of workers. You know, when you talk about this, I learned a couple of things.
Which is what?
Okay, because first of all, she lived to be 101.
She did.
Okay. So number one, it perhaps extends your life not to do housework.
For sure.
Okay?
Yeah.
There is that.
Wait, was she married?
She was married and divorced, yes.
Oh. Ran out of raincoats, perhaps.
Yes.
And the other thing is that it sounds like she was kind of a dreamer.
Yeah.
And maybe being a dreamer extends your life.
Let me, having had the benefit of reading the article in detail, I can tell you she was somewhat of a dreamer and an impossible person to get along with. That was the other part that perhaps helped her extend her to 101.
So these are lessons learned.
Lessons learned. You might
be impossible to get along with.
Exactly. And a hose in the ceiling. Those are the three things to hold.
Well, did she live in one of these houses?
She lived in that house until 10 years ago at the age of 91. Her family decided it was time to move into an assisted living facility. And she left, according to her children, quote, kicking and screaming. And it sounded like that was literally so.
All right.
So
moving right along, when we're on the road,
on the road,
we like to look at the local newspapers,
especially when the New York Times is not available.
So we did toddle down to the Block Island Grocery,
right,
and buy a copy of the Boston Globe.
The Boston Globe, and I will tell you from the first impression that the Boston Globe made on me before I yield the floor to Ms. Granger and others, is that its attitude about its baseball team is extremely different than what you see in New York. And you might say, well, who's a Red Sox fan? Who's a Yankees fan? It's really not that simple. What you see in the Boston Globe is in the sports section, there are not one, not two, not three. There are five separate articles on the Boston Red Sox. Is this the best second baseman ever? What's going to happen in the second half? Who's a good guy in the clubhouse? And on top of that, putting that aside, the lead article in the paper in the news section was a multi-page article on the 1967 Boston Red Sox team, an anniversary team which is now being celebrated for having gone to the World Series. And they do mention, you know, a very exciting time in that season when the Red Sox, who traditionally would basically have only, I don't know, 500 or 1,000 people at a game, if you can believe it, because they were so unpopular and so successful, turned their season around, and that was the Carl Yastrzemski team that went to the World Series against the Cardinals, a very exciting team, and sort of captured the imagination of the city, and Boston's been an even bigger baseball town since. But in any event, it gives you the impression that Boston's in the baseball in the way that New York is not, possibly because there are so many other things going on in New York.
So by your baseball yardstick, you think of the Boston Globe as a superior newspaper?
I would just say Boston's into the Red Sox in a way that New York's not into the Yankees or the Mets.
As much as I love baseball, which you know that I do because I'm the only person here wearing baseball apparel.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to play devil's advocate and say, what are the other sports are going on right now? What else do they have to put in the paper?
Yeah, Dog Days of Summer.
Well, but his point, I think, is that it's five articles about...
My point is sports.
What
there's
else
no football happening.
Okay.
The Tour de France is over. Yes. Wimbledon is over.
And yet, the New York Times meets that challenge every day by writing articles about sports you didn't know existed. So it's just a different perspective on the world.
Well, I think Boston knows that they're going to hit a home run, pun intended.
Yeah.
If they focus on the home team.
Yeah, I guess they are. I guess New York
might have more varied interests.
I think that's true.
But this is true to form, like, super cliche Boston media, right? I mean, like, until the Red Sox had won, well, I think it was recently when I was in college, they hated talking about their World Series teams.
Yeah.
They had, like, two of them basically in the last 100 years or whatever.
Right.
And they hated talking about that kind of stuff. Now it's kind of a new generation of fans where they're actually willing to talk about that stuff. And also, how small-minded and provincial are they that they had six articles about the Boston Red Sox?
It's not small-minded.
Who would care?
It's local enthusiasm. All right, let's move on here. All right. We don't want to make this all about baseball. And so other articles that caught my eye, because we're on vacation and it's rainy. So some of the things that caught my eye in terms of rainy day activities and touristic activities, they have a travel section that mentions independent booksellers, small, cute bookstores in Cape Cod. So if you're vacationing in Cape Cod, where to go? Now, I know, Noelle and Zeke, you were recently in Portland, and part of your Portland adventure was going to a bookstore, right?
We visited Powell's City of Books.
Which is really fun. It's huge.
It is. Yeah. I'm trying to get into reading books. And the going to Powell's was encouraging because maybe it's just the vastness of it or the various categories that they divide the store into. Maybe it's all the many staff recommendations. But for whatever reason, it makes just a building that's just a big fire risk seem exciting. You know, seem like
it's
interesting.
True.
That
it's true.
All
yeah.
these different books, lots of like quality books. That's the impression that they give you, that there's a lot of different interesting stuff just waiting for you there.
Now, the stores they mention in the Boston Globe this week are at the opposite end of the spectrum. Teeny little places, they're like attached to part of someone's house. They have a story of somebody looking out the kitchen window while she's doing dishes, noticing somebody's coming into the shop, you know, and then running over and helping them. So they're small, they're sometimes very focused on a particular maybe vintage books or this, that, and the other thing. But there's a bunch of them, quite a few. And they're a great place to be on a rainy day. They sell not only books, but also, in some cases, rainy day activities, things for kids to do. And they have events. They have luncheons with authors, or, you know, poetry readings and things like that, which do very well, you know, in times like this, when you're looking for an activity and you can't go to the beach unless you're Granger and you're on the beach in the rain. Also a big article, and here's another situation where the newspaper just a few steps behind Dan and Tamsin read the paper, or Tamsin and Dan read the paper. And that is a big article in the magazine section of the Boston Globe about all the things you can borrow at libraries in the Boston area, including guitars, a sewing machine, selfie stick, Roomba, you know, the robot vacuum cleaner, bird watching kit, toys, even seeds, and with the idea that libraries are no longer,
now,
you know,
you can't borrow like a lobster box to go like lobster fishing.
Well, probably everyone already has one of those, but it's for things you don't have.
Yeah.
And again, it's the idea that libraries are no longer limited to just books. They're also a community gathering place, the place where things happen. So that was kind of interesting. We had, you know, seen that a few months ago, actually.
Right.
We talked about that. And so, you know, thinking about these things, I'm also thinking about, you know, beach reads in general and what everybody's reading. And I just wanted to catch everybody up. I claimed a few months ago that I was interested in reading Inheritance from Mother by Mene Mitsumura. And turns out it was a great book. I've been reading that on vacation. Loved it. It's an interesting story about an older woman taking care of her mother and addressing life as she gets older.
You were saying it's Japanese culture, right?
Japanese culture. And that's one of the great things about reading a book, can immerse you in a particular culture. I really am unfamiliar with Japanese culture in any depth. And so it was fun to just, you know, kind of live in that world for a few days while I was reading that book. The author was actually born in Japan, moved to Great Neck with her family when she was 12, was educated in the U.S., went to Yale, also went to the Sorbonne, and quite an education, but is now back in Tokyo and writing in Japanese. So this was translated from the Japanese. And it was a lot of fun, and I recommend it. I think it's an older person's book, though, frankly. I also read Ties by Domenico Starnone, who is theoretically the husband of Elena Ferrante.
Right.
So everybody's kind of dozing off here, so I won't go into that anymore.
Well, they don't know the Elena Ferrante.
You
have to listen to each of
the. It was a good
podcast.
Book, entirely different tone. And I also have to recommend The Sense of an Ending.
Yeah, so this what's unique about this is that what rarely happens, notwithstanding Tamsin's free recommendation of books on the podcast, is Tamsin recommending books that I read. That, you know, that she's already read and enjoyed. And that
yeah,
she
we have pretty somebody, different tastes.
The thought
books.
Is that we have different tastes. But in any event, Tamsin recommended this book to me. And why don't you just say a little bit about it?
Well, the only reason I recommended it is because it was a movie. Came out a few months ago.
Yeah.
Got mediocre reviews. But one review I heard said, this movie wasn't so great, but it reminded me of the book. And the book is great.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'll give it a try. And about three pages into it, I was blown away by the writing. And
It's very good. The Sense of an Ending, and it's kind of it's a very compelling narrative, and it's extremely well written. It's kind of hard to get across exactly what's so capturing about it, but it quite is. And you, the first person narrative, it's a guy who understands things well, puts things simply, puts things in just a few words, and advances the story in. A really compelling way. So
yeah, so I intend to read more Julian Barnes. I know I'm behind the eight ball here. Yeah. I'm sure everybody.
I know everyone else is reading books. I know Zeke was just going on a moment ago on his reading adventures. I don't know if he wants to go into it, but anyone have a book they want to recommend?
Sadie, what are you reading?
I'm reading Superficial by Andy Cohen, which is a daily diary of Andy Cohen's life. And for those who don't know, he's an executive at Bravo, and his best friends are Anderson Cooper, Sarah Jessica Parker, Kelly Ripa, Mark Consuelos, Jerry Seinfeld. So he's constantly at famous events, famous people's houses, and it's just really fun and light.
So it's celebrity gossip.
Yeah.
And fun. So it's, again, sounds like a great vacation read.
I'm reading a book called The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Pleasure. Which isn't as gross as it sounds. it's about it's a woman who's a sociologist who's done research, and her thesis is essentially that she thinks that even though we're looking for equality within feminism, that it might be better to focus more on how happiness plays into women's happiness and how that might make for a more equal world. As long as we're trying to be equal in a patriarchal society, it's harder to be, it's harder to be truly equal. So her idea is that by looking at all the different ways in which women find happiness, we might find a way to create a more equal world that's better for all, which has been...
A similar light read for the summer.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we all need more happiness.
I think nonfiction writing is improving. It's getting more lighthearted and easier to read. She kind of does historical bits, but she also does personal bits and...
Well, you know, I just hope that you guys finish those books so you have time to exchange them before the week's over. Read each other's books.
Well, when we went to Powell's City of Books, at one point I found myself in this room full of promoted and recommended award-winning books, and there was this table that was just all these different Haruki Murakami novels.
Right.
All, like, you know, very much praised and supposed to be one of the great writers of our time. And then I saw that past that table, there was a book with a dog on the cover, and I bought that book. And this is a book called Sirius, spelled like Sirius XM. And it's a book about a dog, a fictional dog, in the time of World War II, starting out in Germany and going on various adventures that take him out of Nazi Germany and into Hollywood. I'm still pretty early on in it. But so far, the strongest impression it has given me is that writing about how cute a dog is when that dog is in fact fictional and you are making up the cuteness of the dog does not make for the most compelling storytelling. So I'm not sure that I'll stick with it, but I'm giving it a chance. All right.
So I should just tell you that I read a Murakami book, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicles, and I was hoping maybe you can read that and explain that to me after you're done with the dog book. Because
like I said before, I'm trying to get into books.
Yeah.
Okay. So I figured
you made a wise choice
first before Wind-Up Bird Chronicles.
That's right.
All right. Well, let me recommend Julian Barnes to you.
Yeah, you would actually like the Julian Barnes book. And both either your mother or I can explain it to you later. So you have that going for you.
Great.
All right. So we just had a couple of points we wanted to cover before we wrap it up. There was... here's something. You know, Martin Landau passed away this week. And Martin Landau was a very interesting actor. He had a long time devotee of the method acting schools, identified with a lot of very famous directors and other actors. His first movie role was North by Northwest with Cary Grant. But he became a character actor, and his biggest role was Mission Impossible. And I'd be going on at great length, except I'm highly conscious today, especially of the generation gap. When Mission Impossible is a TV show, quite apart from whatever the movie's about, was a gripping, very successful show in which this team did impossible missions. And they did it by disguising themselves. And Martin Landau was the key actor in that group because he was always impersonating a foreign diplomat or a foreign surgeon or a businessman or a money changer, whatever it was. He was doing all kinds of accents and having a great time. And he was probably, you know, the most celebrated television actor, such as it was in the late 1960s. But after 3 years, he left because he and his wife, who were both stars of the show, was pretty much a money dispute. And he was replaced by, guess who, Leonard Nimoy, who had finished his run on Star Trek. And the irony of that was, before Leonard Nimoy got his role as Spock on Star Trek, the role was offered to, guess who, Martin Landau. He had turned it down. And it turns out that Martin Landau and Leonard Nimoy were lifelong friends. They kind of knew each other. They grew up in the Northeast, or Jewish actors in the Northeast who were given similar part opportunities because they looked a little bit alike, but they were very different actors. In any event, Landau ended up becoming very good friends with Tim Burton. And did a few Tim Burton movies later in his career, including Ed Wood, for which he won an Academy Award. And I know that some of you guys are big Tim Burton devotees. And there's a quote in the article about Landau here about he and Tim basically can't finish a sentence, the two of them. Well, now they can't. But when they were...
They finish each other's sentences.
They finish each other's sentences. There's so much on the same wavelength. It's hard to imagine a serious actor on the same wavelength as Tim Burton or any human being.
It's scary that someone else is on the same wavelength as Tim Burton.
Yes, but he apparently was. A very creative guy. But you guys don't remember Mission Impossible, the television show, I assume. Am I right? Okay, I'm getting old there.
Know him as Bela Lugosi in Plan 9.
He was much celebrated for playing Bela Lugosi.
Now, of course, we're at the beach, so we see lifeguards.
Right.
And last week there was an article in the Times about lifeguards. And, you know, I'm ambivalent in some ways about this article because it's, you know, it's titled Lifeguards for Life or As Long as Possible. And I'm a little bit ambivalent about articles to say, oh, look at old people doing this. Isn't it cute? Old people can still do things. Enough already, okay? We get it. Very patronizing. But what charmed me about this, and it mentions all kinds of guys. There's a 73-year-old who's still a lifeguard at Tobe Beach. And to be a lifeguard at Tobe Beach, he has to swim 50 yards in under 35 seconds. There's an 82-year-old who's no longer on the beach. He's in charge of lifeguard training, but he's still working in East Hampton. So you have a variety of guys really just still, there's one guy actually comes up from Florida. He has retired and moved with his wife to Florida, but he comes up by himself.
Right, without his wife, so he can lifeguard it.
To still work. But one of the funny things is there is one guy, Roy Lester, 67, who's not lifeguarding this year. And the reason is because when he showed up for the test, you know, the 50-yard swim, he showed up in the bike short kind of swimsuit.
Jammers.
Okay. And they New York State wouldn't let him take the test. He had to be wearing the rules require Speedo attire, which he felt was indecent for a man his age. Okay, so they wouldn't let him take the test. He didn't get the job, and so now he's suing.
He's suing
New York State for age discrimination.
When's the last time you saw a lifeguard on the stand in Speedo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't wear Speedos?
No.
I believe a certain amount of that story, but I'm a little confused by it.
Well, maybe for the test they do it, or who knows? It's a crazy lawsuit, but you look, you guys are all super swimmers. Do you ever take a look at the lifeguard stand on the way in, saying that guy looks like he's up to the task, that guy not,
usually
that guy's
fully closed, first of all.
Yeah, I don't think it's about the clothes, guys. I think it's just about somebody wrote down the rules for the test 50 years ago.
Put the test aside.
And nobody's revised it. Anyway, it's the Speedo suit lawsuit.
Right, but put that the test aside for a moment. I mean, do you ever look at the lifeguard stand and say there's a guy 70 years old there, or what's up, or how's that going
to
help me?
Yeah, if there's a 70-year-old, I leave. I'm there to enjoy the lifeguards. In addition to rely on them.
I see.
Well, the young lifeguards sometimes don't inspire much confidence.
See, that's what I'm thinking. I think you want a 70-year-old, at least a 60-year-old lifeguard. That's the way I enjoy
teenagers who are entirely distracted by all the possibilities of the decades to come. And that's not necessarily what you want. You want someone who can focus on what's happening right now.
You want seasoning.
Okay, we're not hearing about a lot of female 60, 70-year-old lifeguards.
Well, Nico was a lifeguard back then. If she goes back to it when she's older, she could become a 60.
But did you
keep that in mind?
Well, were there older?
Oh, good.
Did you work with older women as lifeguards or not?
Yeah, I mean, coming from Florida, getting actually a job in Florida as a lifeguard was initially impossible for me. So I went to North Carolina and to become an ocean lifeguard at Hilton Head Island because it was much easier. It was seasonal. In Florida, it's a career. It's a complete career. So all the lifeguards are at least 45 years old if you're at a nice beach where you get 9 to 5 hours.
And women do it?
Yeah, I mean,
over 45.
Most lifeguards are going to be older there. I couldn't get a job. My older brother couldn't get a job. The head captain of our swim team could not get a job. So we went to Hilton Head Island.
How do you like that?
Well, my advice, head to Long Island.
Head to Long Island.
Yeah.
No, I think Jones Beach is really competitive for lifeguards as well.
Yeah, I think that's the story.
We've had friends who've been lifeguards at Jones Beach, and it sounds like it's kind of an elite club.
Yeah.
But don't show up in your jammers.
Yes, you got that. But it sounds like Jones Beach is a little more like Florida. There you go. So you have older lifeguards, men and women. Good. All right, so we're going to close with a piece from the New York Times mailbag, which never ceases to surprise. And it's a letter that came in connection with the following big story that the Times wrote in 1932 involving the first cross-Atlantic flight by a woman. And this was the headline, the New York Times, in May 1932 when that first female cross-Atlantic flight took place. Quote, headline, Mrs. Putnam flies Atlantic to Ireland in record time, reaches the Azores.
Mrs. Putnam.
Mrs. Putnam. P-U-T-N-A-M. Mrs. Putnam. And that article resulted in a somewhat stiff letter, and I'll just read you the letter, and it said as follows to the New York Times. I admit I have no principle to uphold in asking that I be called by my professional name in print. For social purposes, I think Putnam's a grand name. However, it is for many reasons more convenient for both of us that I be referred to simply as Amelia Earhart.
So that's shocking.
So Amelia Earhart had to write to the Times so that she be not referred to as Mrs. Putnam, and the Times did not comply immediately with that. It took some time until they convinced themselves as editorial matter that she should be accorded the same deference as movie stars and be allowed to use her own name.
Well, times have changed.
Times have changed.
Thank goodness.
And the Times, thankfully, can laugh at itself.
Times have changed. The time. I see what you did there. That's very good.
All right. So that's all we have for our Block Island broadcast.
This is, we'll see you next week with Tamsin.
And then
read the paper.
And thanks to our guests.
Yes, thanks to our guests. And looking forward to the rest of a fun vacation.
Thank you.